We continue now with the current installment about the story of Rav Mordechai HaTzadik, one of the prominent Talmidei HaBaal Shem Tov, who sought out his friends from yeshiva time, Rav Chaim, Rav Yisrael Heber, in order to acquaint them with the Baal Shem Tov and his teachings. Rav Mordechai had found Rav Chaim in the city of Dubrovna, and Rav Mordechai so impressed the people there that he was appointed the Shtot Magid, the town preacher, and he caused a vast change both within Rav Chaim as well as within the entire community in Dubrovna. Last time we spoke about the service of Rav Chaim, during Yom Kippur, and also the concluding aspect of the service, as well as the dance that he went with the assembled after Kiddush Levana, and where Rav Mordechai realized that the Jews had not yet broken their fast of Yom Kippur. So he went into the Beis HaMedrash to recite Havdalah. On the way, Rav Mordechai mentioned that for several years now, it had been his custom at the end of Yom Kippur to recite Havdalah over absinthe, which is a strong liquor brewed from certain plants. And he dispatched someone to fetch him some absinthe. Meanwhile, he and Rav Chaim went into his private chamber. Everyone was very impressed by the changes in Rav Chaim Porush's conduct. Previously, he had led the life of a recluse and ascetic, never conversing with other people unless they approached him to discuss a question in Torah. No one had ever seen a cheerful expression on his face. Even on Simchas Torah, Rav Chaim would hide his face in the mantle of a Torah scroll. When he was given a scroll for a kofes on the eve of Shmini Atzeres, they would wrap a tablecloth around Rav Chaim together with the Torah scroll. Then he would stand there with his head and face encased in the Torah cover to avoid looking at anyone outside his immediate vicinity. With the tablecloth tied around himself in the Torah, Rav Chaim would rock back and forth 3 or 4 times while standing in place. This was sufficient for him to be able to say that he had danced in honor of the Torah and in honor of the festival of Simchas Torah. Following this, the Gabbai would untie the tablecloth and return the Torah scroll to the Aron Kodesh, to the Holy Ark, while Rav Chaim was led into the side room. And only then would he remove the Torah cover from his head and face. He would remain quietly seated in the dark at his usual place until someone came to take him by the hand and lead him home. But now, this very same Rav Chaim Porush was talking with people and looking directly at them. Why, he had even become a dancer. Now Rav Chaim had experienced the wonderful high holiday period, and he had heard Rav Mordechai davening Nila. The Jews whom he had met in the Beis HaMedrash told him that from the time Rav Mordechai had stood up to recite Al-Chet after Mincha on the eve of Yom Kippur, he had remained standing until he finished Ma'ariv about an hour before daybreak. Only then had Rav Mordechai sat down for a while, immersed in thought. Afterwards, he had begun his preparations for the morning davening, and an hour after daybreak, he began to daven shacharis, and he had recited all the tefillos, all the prayers, without taking a single break, other than an aliyah to the Torah, and he continued that way until that moment. All this, along with the dancing after Kiddush Levana, made a profound impression on Rav Chaim. Upon entering Rav Mordechai's quarters, he tried to say something to him, but was unable to speak. Rav Mordechai perceived that Rav Chaim wished to say something, but he was hesitating. Rav Mordechai too had something he wished to say to Rav Chaim. Rav Mordechai had decided that now, after Yom Kippur had ended, that now was the appropriate time to deliver the Baal Shem Tov's message to Rav Chaim. But upon noticing that Reb Chaim had something to say, he decided to wait until after he heard Reb Chaim's remarks. For Reb Mordechai, by nature, was very patient, and he always preferred to wait and to think everything over carefully before he spoke. Reb Chaim felt quite shallow and insignificant, for he had already begun to comprehend how mistaken his past ways had been, and how great a favor and a service Reb Mordechai had done to him. Therefore, he now held Reb Chaim in the greatest esteem. After Reb Mordechai invited him several times to speak his mind, he finally found the courage to say that he wished to hear the message that Reb Mordechai had brought to him from his own holy Rebbe, the Baal Shem Tov. "I think," said Reb Chaim, "that the night following Yom Kippur is an appropriate time for receiving such a holy message. I have decided that if you, Reb Mordechai, agree that this is the proper time, I will continue fasting until after I hear the holy words that the saintly Baal Shem Tov has sent to me." Reb Mordechai, on his part, was very pleased that Reb Chaim had acquired such a refined notion that the Rebbe's message should be received only on such a holy occasion and while one is still fasting, so that the Rebbe's holy words be heard with the aura of the fast day still permeating the listener and the hearer of the message. Reb Mordechai detected exchange in Reb Chaim. Not only had he exchanged his coarse attitudes for refined ones, but he also had become a fit kele, a fit receptacle to hear the Rebbe's words. Reb Chaim was now an appropriate vessel to acquire the Rebbe's ways and to hear the Rebbe's special message to him. Reb Mordechai began thinking to himself. Only now did he realize how difficult his assignment was, and moreover, how great his responsibility was. The rule is that Shlucha Shel Odom Kemoisei, a person's agent is considered as equivalent to the person himself. And he was, after all, the Rebbe's Shliach, the Rebbe's emissary. But in carrying out his assignment, there was always the possibility of making a mistake. Being a great Torah scholar, Reb Mordechai quickly reviewed in his mind all the passages in the Babylonian and Jerusalem Talmud where the topics of agent of Shluchim is discussed, the duties and obligations of a Shliach, and the differences between an agent and a servant. And so, thinking about all this, Reb Mordechai remained for some time deeply immersed in thought. Reb Mordechai pictured to himself an exact image of the Rebbe's holy face and clearly called to mind the Baal Shem Tov's appearance and the sound of his voice when the Rebbe had spoken to him the words of the message that he was to convey to Reb Chaim. Reb Mordechai's face became red and a great excitement overtook him. Reb Mordechai rose and declared, "These are the holy words that the holy Rebbe, the Baal Shem Tov, entrusted to me. I now transmit the message word for word and letter for letter as I received it from the Rebbe." And then he went on to say that the Baal Shem Tov said to Reb Chaim, "Say that if he comes to me, I will give him a program of study of Zohar and Medrash that will bring about Psichus HaLev. It will expand and open up his emotional capacities." Reb Mordechai had musical talent, and he did his best to transmit the words in exactly the same tone of voice that he had heard from the Rebbe. He repeated the message in this manner three times in succession. The Chaim, for his part, detected a genuine prophecy in the message the holy Baal Shem Tov had sent him. "This great tzaddik must be a mind reader," he thought. He stood transfixed with wonder. An aura of ecstasy surrounded him, and Reb Chaim radiated joy. Upon seeing Reb Chaim's utter delight in receiving this message, Reb Mordechai himself was deeply moved, for he now knew that he had successfully completed this portion of his mission. He seized Reb Chaim by the hand and began to dance with him. He was sure was Reb Mordechai, that the Rebbe, the Baal Shem Tov, was aware that the message had been transmitted to Reb Chaim, and that the Rebbe saw the great joy that Reb Chaim had derived from receiving this message. Reb Mordechai began to think how the Rebbe, the Baal Shem Tov, sees everything, and was surely pleased by Reb Chaim's being drawn to the Derech HaBaal Shem Tov, to the ways of the Baal Shem Tov. Reb Mordechai began singing a joyful yet poignant melody, and he danced ecstatically, completely forgetting that he had not yet said Havdalah. In the homes of the townspeople and the young folk who had not yet come home from the Beis HaMedrash, families began to wonder anxiously why the menfolk were not home yet. Thus, more people gathered, and the news spread throughout the town to all the homes where people were still awake that something was happening in the large Beis HaMedrash. No one knew exactly, except for those who were actually there, what was taking place. So the rumors started flying. Some said that the Maggid was preaching a sermon, while others said that Reb Chaim Parsh and other scholars had come to the Maggid for a ruling on some serious matter of Jewish law. All of this, of course, caused some commotion in town, so that in several homes where they were already sleeping, people awoke. The man whom Reb Mordechai had asked to fetch the absinthe for Havdalah was a leading citizen of the city. Although not much of a scholar himself, he was a very God-fearing individual who held Torah scholars in great esteem. He was quite wealthy, this individual, owning a large warehouse right in the middle of the marketplace, as well as several grocery stores, and he lived in a large, well-furnished house. Being a person of means and of good reputation, he had managed with God's help to marry off five of his daughters to son-in-laws who were fine Torah scholars with excellent intellectual abilities and the best character traits. Even their mother-in-law, who was famous in her own right throughout the vicinity for her hospitality and for befriending every sad soul, used to say that such wonderful and refined young gentlemen are not easily found. Two of these son-in-laws were opponents of the Maggid, and more than once there were harsh words among the brother-in-laws about him. The other three young men, however, were the Maggid's adherents. They enjoyed his sermons immensely and managed to take home some lesson with regard to their actual conduct and Avodas Hashem from every one of the Maggid's drushes, from every one of the Maggid's sermons. This could not be said, however, about the two eldest brothers-in-law. They respected, through the Maggid's genius, and would approach him quite often to discuss matters of Torah. Afterwards, they would review between themselves the intricacies of the Maggid's reply. But they nevertheless disliked him. Deep in their heart, they remained opponents, and they harbored a secret hatred towards the Maggid. But since they were good people, this hatred went undetected. All that the family knew was that the two older son-in-laws were not quite as fond of the Maggid as were the three younger sons-in-law. When this man, who was sent by the Maggid to receive the Havdalah, to obtain the Havdalah, the absinthe for Havdalah, his name was Sholem Ivansker, a great uncle of the Beryl Ivansker, who was the father of Zalman Leib, who quite possibly was the one who told this story to the previous Rebbe. When this man, Absholem, came home to get the absinthe for Mordechai's Havdalah, all his children, daughters, sons-in-law, and unmarried children surrounded him and wished him a good year. His wife told him that the children had refused to say Havdalah or break the fast until he had arrived, but she had compelled them to eat something. "I gathered that you were at the Maggid's, and I assumed that you would not leave until the Maggid went to bed," she said. She placed the silver Kiddush and Havdalah goblet before him, while one of the children brought the wine and another one brought the Havdalah candle and the psalmim. "No," said Reb Sholem, "I only came to fetch Havdalah supplies for the Maggid and for Reb Chaim Parsh. The Maggid finished davening Nila only a short while ago. And what a davening that was. With great enthusiasm, he began to describe how the Magid had davened Nila and how Reb Chaim Parash, along with many others, several of whom he mentioned by name, who had remained in the Beis HaMedrash, had listened to the Magid's davening, which was followed by Ma'ariv. When Reb Sholem told of the Magid's Kiddush Levona and the dancing afterwards, they all remained seated or standing in amazement. Then said Reb Sholem, the Magid mentioned that it has been his custom for some time now to recite Havdalah after Yom Kippur on absinthe. So I came home to get some absinthe. Armed with the absinthe and food and Havdalah supplies for all the people in the shul who were still fasting, Reb Sholem made his way back to the shul. And his sons-in-law, hearing that their father-in-law was returning to the Beis HaMedrash, went along as well. The two older sons-in-law, however, were quite annoyed. They said nothing, but in their hearts they resented the Magid. Reb Sholem, his sons-in-law, and two unmarried sons went to the Beis HaMedrash bearing the Havdalah supplies and the food for breaking the fast. When they arrived, several minyanim of men were still sitting or standing around the table at the south wall, engaged in passionate conversation, repeating the stories they had heard Reb Chaim Parash telling earlier, the stories about the great tzaddik of Podolia Volhynia, known in that region as the Baal Shem Tov. Upon hearing the Magid singing, the crowd in the Beis HaMedrash began moving into the Magid's side room, where the Magid's quarters had been partitioned off from the rest of the shul. A few of the younger folk ran out of the Beis HaMedrash into the back alley where the windows to the Magid's chamber were located. They could see what was happening in the Magid's private room through the window. The side room was quite large. It was narrow but very long. But so many people crowded themselves inside the room that the thin wooden partition of the Magid's quarters began to cave in and the door flew off its hinges. But Reb Mordechai and Reb Chaim were so deeply immersed in their fervent dancing that they remained totally unaware of all this. Part of the crowd pressed into the Magid's room as the pushing and crowding became more and more intense by the minute. All those who saw the uniquely ecstatic slow dance and the deeply absorbed look on the dancers' faces of Reb Mordechai and Reb Chaim and heard the rapturous and joyful melody were mentally and emotionally drawn into the dancing, even as they stood fixed in their places. Suddenly, the shamus's young son, who had been sleeping on a bench in the side room near the Magid's wall, awoke and began screaming hysterically that he was being squashed to death. At that point, Reb Sholem Ivansker announced that he had brought the Havdalah supplies, and the dance ended. Reb Mordechai and Reb Chaim entered the Beis HaMedrash to recite Havdalah. All those who had not yet done so now said Havdalah and helped themselves to the food that Reb Sholem's son Hirschel had brought. Being in high spirits, Reb Mordechai summoned several young men in Bochum whom he knew to have good voices and began to teach them a niggun. He explained that immediately upon the conclusion of Yom Kippur, one must begin preparing for Sukkot. Since Sukkot is Man Simchaseinu, the festival of rejoicing, the holiday should be graced with elegant song. They had been singing for quite some time when Reb Mordechai reached a high level of excitement and began to deliver a fiery lecture on the subject of mitzvah b'li kavona keguf b'li neshama, that a mitzvah done without a proper and inner intent is like a body bereft of a soul. In concise terms, but quite sharply, Reb Mordechai explained to them what Avodas Hashem, what divine service is all about. For without Avodah, for without true inner service, all the Torah that is studied and all the mitzvahs that are done do not amount to no more than a lifeless course. It is a guf b'li neshama, a body without a soul. A vast cemetery, declared Reb Mordechai, looking at the young scholars, including Reb Sholem Ivansker's son-in-laws, and particularly at the foremost scholars among them. a vast cemetery filled with the corpses of your dead pages of Gemara is what you've built up in the world to come. And in the world of truth, you lead the sages of the Talmud around, bound up in the chains of your vanity and arrogance. The only thing that any one of you is concerned with is that people acknowledge that you are right. Each one of you desires to be known as the Godel HaDor, as the foremost scholar. None of you cares about the true essence of Torah, that the Torah is the Word of God. How much longer will this sinful situation continue? Young fellows, the Maggid cried out in a tearful voice, take pity on yourselves and on your own souls that have entered your bodies to perfect the world around you. And the Maggid went on to say, the Pasuk says, bathe yourselves and purify yourselves, study well, seek out justice. The meaning of this is, explained Rav Mordechai, bathe yourselves, wash away your haughty spirits and your gaiva, your haughtiness. Purify yourselves, become cleansed of your arrogance. Study well means to put your neshama, put your soul into your study. And finally, seek out justice, that you should apply whatever your study in judging your own conduct and determining whether your behavior conforms to the character traits demanded by the Torah that you are studying. Rav Mordechai then went on to relate how the Baal Shem Tov had sent a great scholar and tzaddik, the rabbi of a large congregation, to a butcher to learn the trait of Yiras Hashem, of truly being God-fearing. Another great scholar and tzaddik, who had lived a solitary and chaste life for many years, was sent by the Baal Shem Tov to the shamas of a Beis HaMedrash, to the beadle of a small synagogue, to learn the trait of humility. The Rebbe, said Rav Mordechai, is very fond of the simple Jews with their unpretentious davening and recitation of psalms. The Rebbe, the Baal Shem Tov, says that the most unsophisticated Jew is an eternal, untapped treasury of faith and trust in God, and possesses the finest character traits. All the while Rav Mordechai was speaking, and Rav Chaim sat and wept silently. Rav Mordechai's lecture, comparing mitzvahs without their inner intent to a body without a soul, affected him greatly. Having sat for so many years in the gravedigger's Beis HaMedrash, and having attended so many funerals, an image of the faces of a number of corpses had remained engraved upon his mind. Now, when Rav Mordechai compared study without chayis, without vitality, to a corpse without a soul, and he spoke about the cemetery of the dead pages of Gemara that they had studied, Reb Chaim was deeply moved. In his imagination, he pictured the cemetery of the pages of Gemara, and a Chevra Kadisha, a burial society of angels, performing the funeral rites for the dead pages. As Reb Mordechai continued speaking, Reb Chaim, lost in the crowd, and crammed among the people, continued to weep. The more Rav Mordechai spoke words of arousal, the more bitterly Rav Chaim cried. When Rav Mordechai reached the part about take pity on yourselves and on your own souls that have entered your bodies to perfect the world around you, bathe yourself, purify yourself, Rav Chaim began weeping violently, something that made a tremendous impact upon all who were present in the Beis HaMedrash. Most of the people assembled in the Beis HaMedrash took special delight in Rav Mordechai's stories about how the Baal Shem Tov held simple Jews in such high esteem, and even sent great scholars to simple Jews so that they could learn good character traits from them. The Baal Shem Tov saying that every Jew, even the most unsophisticated, is an eternal untapped treasury of innocent faith and trust in God, became etched in everyone's mind and heart. Suddenly, Rav Mordechai remembered where he had been at that same time a year earlier at the Baal Shem Tov, and he began singing a passionate nigun, one of those that were regularly sung at the Baal Shem Tov's table. This particular nigun was called the Chapesh Umtzei Nigun, the search and find song. It consists of three movements, and each movement contains three themes. The first theme of the first movement of the search and find nigun depicts a mood of solitude, creating an image of someone sitting isolated in the field, deeply hidden among the mountains, next to a blue stream of running water. In the distance, at the other end of this valley, appears a rocky precipice upon which a few sparse trees grow. Here the singer sits alone and sings his song of solitude. The second theme depicts a mood of introspective meditation. The solitary singer becomes more introverted, debating with himself and subjecting himself to rigorous self-examination. The longer he sings, the more deeply introverted his thoughts become. The person is dissatisfied with himself and begins to discover certain flaws in his own character. Now comes the third theme, in which the singer breaks into weeping, at first silently, but becoming progressively more intense. The nigun's second movement also contains three themes. Although they differ in sequence and key, they possess a common motif, a song of searching and of longing. This movement creates an image of a person searching for some elusive object for which he longs. Suddenly he perceives a ray of hope, a promise that he will eventually find the thing for which he seeks and craves. But this ray of hope evaporates, for it turns out that the subject is not what he was hoping for after all. Once more, he becomes submerged in melancholy until he finds the thing he has been seeking. Then comes the nigun's third movement, also containing three themes. The overall mood of this movement begins in a joyous mode, with a beat that makes one lift his feet to dance. As the nigun progresses, the beat becomes faster and more fervent, reaching a fiery crescendo that leaves the singer panting for breath. The music now consists of only a few isolated notes issuing forth from the depths of the heart, creating the impression of musical notes chasing after and desperately trying to keep up with the rapidly moving, feverishly dancing feet, and evoking images of the impassioned but contented faces of the dancers. This was the nigun that Rav Mordechai wished to teach the young folk in Bochum. To everyone's amazement, they assimilated the entire nigun after the first three repetitions, and by the fourth time, the young folk were singing the song correctly by themselves. Some of the bystanders were able to join in with a few bars of the melody. When they came to the third movement, Rav Mordechai took hold of Reb Chaim and began to dance with him in earnest, requesting that everyone present join them in the dancing. Several generations later, the Bel Ivansker related that whenever Hirschel, the son of Reb Sholem Ivansker, told the story of what happened in the large Beis HaMedrash on that night after Yom Kippur, it was a pleasure to listen. In spite of Reb Hirschel Ben Reb Sholem's advanced age, he would demonstrate the brisk steps with which Reb Mordechai and Reb Chaim had danced while singing the third movement of the Search and Find Nigun. Everyone was astounded that Reb Mordechai and Reb Chaim were able to dance for so long and with such a quick step that their slippers barely touched the floor. They were especially amazed by Reb Chaim's performance, for he was no more than skin and bones. It was obvious that they were possessed by some supernatural power. Everyone else, including the youngest, had collapsed like bundles of straw, and they lay there drenched with perspiration, without a drop of strength remaining. But Reb Mordechai and Reb Chaim continued to dance. Their faces were flaming red, their eyes shut, and their hot breath, along with extremely rapid panting sounds, issued from their mouths. Finally, the Chaim began to waver and drop, and a few of the bystanders called him and led him to a bench to rest. Reb Mordechai managed to continue dancing a bit longer, but then he emerged from his dveikus and inquired what time it was. Upon learning that it was almost 2 o'clock in the morning, he sighed and went into his private bedroom saying that it was time to recite Tikkun Chatzos, the midnight prayers. The men who had come to the large base of Medrash for Chatzos had arrived quite some time earlier. It struck them as very odd to find the Malkut busy singing, for they were aware of no occasion for joy that would warrant such singing. Nevertheless, they did not presume to begin saying Chatzos before the Magid finished dancing. A short while later, the Magid re-entered the Beis HaMedrash, took off his slippers, and began reciting Tikkun Chatzos. Before the Tikkun Chatzos was finished, the Chevrat Tila members were already beginning to gather in the large Beis HaMedrash. Whenever a Mordechai recited Psalms with the simple Jews, he would do so with an especially joyful delight. By nature, a Mordechai was a very deliberate person, and he hated doing anything in a hurry, especially when it came to davening or study. Tehillim 2, he recited very slowly, paying attention to the meaning of the words. Quite often he would pause and meditate over their inner significance. But that was only when Rav Mordechai said Tehillim by himself. When he said them together with the society of Tehillim, he drove himself to keep up with them. From time to time, Rav Mordechai would look at one or another of the Tehillim Jews with a benevolent and loving glance. When doing so, he would say to himself, "These are the simple Jews whom the Rebbe the Baal Shem Tov calls the timeless, untapped treasury of innocent faith and hope." The continuation of this story, Emir Sashem, the next installment.